Argue, argue, talk, 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 exaggerate, pontificate, just shut up. Talk. Why won't you listen? Argue, why won't you see? I know the story, just listen to me.
You're better off when you're spouting off. And now, here's your host, Karen Cataline.
And welcome to Spouting Off. This is Karen Cataline, and I have an extremely special show for you this afternoon. I am delighted to be here on site at Hillsdale College for their CCA program. This is something that they offer 2-3 times a year. Now, regular listeners of our show, 4 times a year, regular listeners of our show will notice that we play the Hillsdale College Constitutional Minute on our program as part of our commercial break. And here I am in person on the campus of Hillsdale College. I am an enormous fan of Hillsdale College. And so this hour, we're going to feature two professors from Hillsdale that teach in the journalism and the broadcasting department. I just want to mention that next week we will be talking, unless so much news has happened that we'll have to change something else. But tonight, and we are broadcasting live on January 30th, we are going to hear Donald Trump's first State of the Union speech. So we're all looking forward to that. I'll be taking notes and I'll be taking your calls. So without further ado, I'm just going to get right in and talk with our very first guest, the head of the I've got so much to tell about you. I'm not going to say too much. Director of the Herbert H. Dow II Program in American Journalism. He also writes for National Review and Wall Street Journal. He's the head of the broadcasting department, and I just got to hear the journalism department, I should say, and I just got to hear a panel discussion with him and our second guest that we'll have. He's a national correspondent, and at the very end of his bio, it says he lives on a dirt road in rural Michigan, and that could be a really good thing. So welcome, John J. Miller. It's great to have you on Spouting Off.
Hi, Karen. Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, it's a pleasure. And you've done a lot of this sort of thing, so it's way fun. During the panel discussion, you made it very clear, and I want all our listeners to know what you said, because it was important. You say a lot of important things. President Arnn, as a matter of fact, said this very same thing to me when the journalism department was a lot less developed than it is now. I asked him, can you get a major and a degree in journalism at Hillsdale College? And then what did you say?
No, you cannot. So we have a journalism program here at Hillsdale College, and we do train people in journalism, but journalism is a minor here. And I get this question all the time. People assume that there's a major in journalism. There's a major in journalism at a lot of schools, and there are graduate schools in journalism and so on and so forth. It's only a minor here, and that's how it ought to be. Hillsdale College is a liberal arts school. It is at its very best when it is teaching in the traditional academic curriculum, traditional subjects like economics and biology and English and history and those sorts of things. And that's how we want our future journalists trained. If you're going to be an economics reporter, if you're going to cover business, if you're going to cover jobs reports, if you're going to cover the unemployment rate, do you want that journalist to be someone who went to college and spent all his time in classes called gender and media? or do you want that journalist to be someone who actually has an economics degree? Our feeling is that someone who is broadly educated in liberal arts and then has a concentration and a major in a traditional academic discipline is that's the best possible training for so many things in life, but especially for journalism. The other thing is with journalism, we believe you learn it not in the classroom. You learn journalism by doing journalism. Mm-hmm. So we do a few things in the classroom. We have some writing classes, and I teach a course called The History of Journalism and things like that. But by and large, we get our students writing. They work for a weekly student newspaper here on campus. They work for our radio station, which is a 24/7 news talk station here on campus, writing their own articles, producing their own content. And that's how you learn how to do journalism, by doing journalism, by doing the work, doing the interviews, writing the articles, laying out the pages of a newspaper, sitting in front of a microphone and giving a weathercast or interviewing somebody. This is how you learn journalism. So it's a minor here. We keep them busy. Boy, it's a big commitment if you make it. It's kind of like a club or an extracurricular activity. We keep these folks busy, but it is a minor.
I wish I could be 30 years younger and
don't we all
completely, but for the main reason is so I could go to Hillsdale College, because 30 years ago I had absolutely no idea I'd be doing something like this. And sometimes one thing leads to another. While you were talking, I was thinking about the number of people who went to places like Columbia School of Journalism and whatever, and why do they go? They go to change the world, right?
Right. And so this is a big problem in journalism, the belief that this is about power, then, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, this is how I'm going to change the world. And why is this such a strong impulse in journalism? There are lots of reasons for this. I think a lot of it goes back to frankly, the 1970s. And Watergate and Woodward and Bernstein. And without commenting on the quality of their reporting.
You want.
Well, there's a lot to be said about it because some of it was good, some of it was quite controversial, and you can pick it apart. But they became celebrities. Movies were made about these guys, right? Robert Redford played.
They're still around.
Yeah, Robert Redford.
The real guys are still around.
Yeah, they still are. Yeah. Robert Redford played Bob Woodward. Dustin Hoffman played Carl Bernstein. And so they were celebrated as the guys who took down a president, mm-hmm. right? And they were these sort of heroic figures who challenged the establishment, the corrupt establishment. They took it down through their hard investigative reporting. And, you know, there's some truth to that, but it should not be the goal of reporters to take down governments, right? Certainly not in the United States. I mean, so your role should be to, you know, report on the events of the day, observe, and tell the truth about them. Mm-hmm. But I think what happened in the wake of All the President's Men, first the book, then the movie, especially the movie, is a lot of young people got the idea that you go into journalism because you want to change the world, because this is the way to fight corruption, and you can crusade against this, you can be a social justice warrior for that. And it has infected so many newsrooms and affected the way the news gets made and consumed, and sometimes in ways that are obvious to us and also in ways that are not obvious to us.
Here's an interesting piling on to what you're saying, which is that the people that get into journalism to change the world only want to change the world in one direction. And so while you turn out journalists that you hope have decent, even stellar journalistic values, and they understand the difference between opinion reporting and hard news reporting, they understand the difference between facts and opinion, how can they, these students who come out of brilliant Hillsdale College, fight a situation in which 98% of the people in the media are not only changing the world, but they're changing the world towards a socialist utopia?
Well, there's only so much we can do, obviously. And my goal here is to graduate, you know, 8, 10, 12, 14 young journalists every year who go into the professional media and can just be good journalists who tell the truth about what they observe and what they learn, what they report. Just go tell the truth. And does that correct some of the imbalances that we know exist? I think it helps, certainly. And we are graduating some very outstanding young people. We'll see, though. I mean, we're playing a long game, right? When you're in the business of educating young people, mm-hmm. and making sure they know what's in the Constitution and how to read the Constitution, how to interpret the Constitution, in every way, when you're making these investments in young people, what's the payoff? You know, we won't know until we're gone, right?
That's true.
That's it's you know, what's there. There could be a Secretary of State on our campus right now.
Absolutely.
Right? But that's 40 years from
what
now.
What rarefied air. I mean, you just walk on this campus. I mean, I invite all our listeners to make a visit to Hillsdale College. It is an extraordinary place. Getting back to what you said, though, how savvy are they? How much do you cover in your courses about stories like Cheryl Atkinson, who wrote a book about literally being shut down by CBS News, and she's suing CBS News. I mean, this is one voice in the wilderness. I mean, what a courageous lady she is.
Well, we had Cheryl Atkinson on campus 2 years ago.
She'll be in Colorado in April.
Good. And so, so she came here and spoke and met with students. And so that was a great way to learn her story and what she has found herself up against. I know a few of our students are big admirers of her. Of her work. But how often do we talk about it? Frankly, not much at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, most of the work we do in the classroom with the students is, you know, how do you write a lead? How do you source something properly? What should the flow of the story look like? It's grammar sometimes. Mm-hmm. I teach a history of journalism class, which is basically, you know, the great books of journalism. We start with John Milton and Areopagitica in the 1640s.
Who?
And John Milton,
John Milton.
John Milton, the guy who wrote Paradise Lost. Uh-huh. And before he wrote Paradise Lost, he was an essayist and pamphleteer. And in the 1640s, he wrote an essay called Areopagitica, which is the first great statement of press freedom that was ever written anywhere. Really, I was going to say in the West, but really anywhere. And we start with that in September. And for the course throughout the year, because it's a two-semester, two-sequence kind of course, we start there. And by April, we're getting into Tom Wolfe and Hunter S. Thompson and, I guess last day of class we're on Twitter or something, but we don't spend a lot of time going over current controversy. Sometimes they pop up and students want to discuss them, and we will do that. But that's not the focus of what we do for sure.
I have one more question on that train of thought, because when I was I was watching your panel, and it was just wonderful yesterday, and I did ask a question about something along this line. As a person who's connected to the outside world and probably more of a news junkie than I've ever been in my life, and I was for a long time, I was struck by kind of what a bubble it is here in the sense that, I mean, I'm glad. I mean, there's got to be a place for Hillsdale. Hillsdale, in my opinion, the long game, this is what could save this country, what will save this country, places like Hillsdale College. That being said, there seems to be such a circumspect approach, an academic approach, which of course is appropriate, to the people who come here and are living through this unbelievable criminal negligence that we're seeing in journalism, where a whole half of the country has never heard the name Peter Strzok or Lisa Page, and the other half of the country is hearing an entirely different narrative that is provably false or hasn't seen any facts at all. Now, I don't have the historical knowledge you have, but I know there's something really, really sinister, awful going on out there. And I want kids from Hillsdale to be savvy about that.
And see, I think they will, because of the kind of education we give them. Look, very soon they will be off in the world. They will be immersed in the very thing you just described. Mm-hmm. Coming here to college is an opportunity to prepare yourself for that. Mm-hmm. And look, they're immersed in it now. I mean, this is the news they read. They think about this stuff. We talk about this stuff. Mm-hmm. But we also want to learn things like, in my history journalism class, what is the story of freedom of speech and freedom of the press?
It's a grounding.
Why do we have it?
Right.
What went into the First Amendment? And what do those words in the First Amendment really mean?
Right.
You've got to learn that stuff before you can go off and fight all of these other battles. And that's true in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we want them to be engaged as informed young people out in the world, understanding what the Constitution says. Mm-hmm. So you know every student at Hillsdale College has to take a course in the Constitution. I think we may be mm-hmm. the only college in America that requires that. I think with the exception of the service academies, you also have to mm-hmm. do it there. But every student at Hillsdale College has to take a course in the U.S. Constitution. You cannot graduate from this college without having done that. It doesn't matter if you're going into business or you're a jock on the football team or a biology major. You've got to take a course on the Constitution. But I'll tell you, there's so many constitutional controversies right now. We can wade into all that, but really they need to read the Constitution. They need to know what it says. They need to know the history behind it. They need to know the history that it has influenced, why it's interpreted certain ways now, arguably where yeah. we went wrong. And so that does take, they need to step back and learn that stuff.
And one could make a very good argument, and it's an accurate argument, that one of the reasons we're in the position we're in now is because our populace does not know those things. And just for our listeners, again, one of the great things Hillsdale College does, it doesn't just educate young people who are brilliant and have 3.9 grade point averages or 4 point whatever. It offers an enormous number of adult education courses in the Constitution, and you can do these online. They're always free. And if we're going to fight the battle, we have to be armed with the information.
Well, is there a crisis in journalism today? Well, yeah, maybe. Is there a crisis?
Oh, come on, yeah.
Well, hang on. Is there a crisis yeah. in our courts today? Well, maybe. Is there a crisis in our politics? You know, behind all of it is a crisis in education.
Yeah,
and the way we teach students, and so sure. Hillsdale College is an opportunity to take a step back, mm-hmm. and you know, we're interested in Cheryl Atkinson, mm-hmm. but to give our students the background and the know-how to mm-hmm. understand the full picture, and then as far as the journalists go, go out there and tell the truth about what they see and know.
Exactly, that's superb, and you convinced me on that level. As far as optimism goes, you know, from where I'm sitting, one of the things I find incredibly encouraging is the new journalism that's being the opportunities there for people like James O'Keefe to do the work that the mainstream media refuses to do. Do you have any students who are real interested in doing that kind of investigative journalism?
Well, so that's a complicated question. Is James O'Keefe a journalist?
What do you think?
Well, I actually think when you try and make up stories and plant them in the Washington Post, that kind of complicates the question. Mm-hmm. I love some of what he does, and I have loved some of the results of his work. I think mm-hmm. what he did most recently is problematic, and that as journalists, mm-hmm. your number one responsibility is to tell the truth. Mm-hmm. And he was involved in a scheme mm-hmm. that involved telling a lie. Mm-hmm. And so that troubles me. You know, having said that, I've enjoyed the results of some of his previous investigations. I say a couple things about journalism today. On the one hand, you know, I think journalism in some sense has never been better than right now. And what I mean by that is it's never been easier for ordinary people to get accurate information about what's happening in the world. If you want to look up what President Obama said in the State of the Union address 2 years ago, mm-hmm. you can have that information in 30 seconds.
That's true.
Right? A generation ago, you had to scratch your head. Well, where, you know, what library do I go to find that? Right? And it becomes a half day trip or whatever.
Yes.
You know, as a reporter, that is such a tremendous asset to have this stuff at your fingertips anytime. You know, we're just drowning in information, and mm-hmm. that's a wonderful thing. That gives us so much ability to know what's going on in the world. It's never been easier to know as much as we can possibly know now. Now, there's a flip side to this. I say journalism's never been better on the one hand. On the other hand, it's never been worse. Mm-hmm. You know, we're overflowing in information, and it's increasingly difficult for us to discriminate and to know what's good information, mm-hmm. what's bad information, mm-hmm. because there's an awful lot of it out there. You know, just because you read it on the internet doesn't mean it's true. So So journalism's never been better. It's never been worse. I'll say this also, with the breakup of the mainstream media, which we have seen over the last generation, young people often fail to appreciate the power that a handful of institutions held just 20 years ago. And by that, I mean the New York Times, the Washington Post, ABC, NBC, CBS Nightly News, right? Those five institutions controlled so much of the flow of information in this country. They dominated everything, and they were run by liberals. Mm-hmm. And they proclaimed themselves to be objective. And in many cases, they tried to be objective, but they were full of their own biases. Some they were aware of, some they were not aware of, but they were full of their own biases. But there were these, see, just five organs of dissemination that controlled so much of the news that was gathered and disseminated around the country. Today, we have a gazillion different options. Mm-hmm. And that's been good for conservatives. Because finally we have ways to talk to each other. We have ways to explain how we see the world and how we understand it and how we interpret it. And that's a tremendously powerful thing. I'll say one other thing. The period we're in right now, the period of journalism we're in right now, which feels like the Wild West. There are websites, there's social media, everybody barking at each other and so on. You know what this is like? This is what journalism was like when the Constitution was written.
That's not a bad thing.
And no, it's not at all. It can be mean. Mm-hmm. It can be spiteful.
Yeah.
It can be full of inaccuracies. It can be full of lies. That's what Alexander Hamilton and James Madison and George Washington and all these guys were dealing with.
And they shot each other, some of them.
Oh, and they, right. Literally. You know, while we tell ourselves bedtime stories about the founding fathers, like they're all friends, right?
Right.
But no, I mean,
some of them hated each other.
Yeah, some of them came to hate each other. And they had their allies in the press who would, as I say, sometimes just make up things about these different figures. And so I'm always telling my students, you think Twitter's mean? You think some of the things you read in the comments section of you think that's mean? Go back and look at some of the newspapers of the 1790s and see what they were saying, because it's not that different.
Did you think that the general public was as ignorant as they are today?
Well, I think
and they were depending on their representatives to understand the big issues of the day.
I think there's always been a lot of ignorance, right? Uh-huh. I mean, people, how many people read the Constitution in 1795? I'm sure some did, but there were a lot more illiterate people then than there are now today too. Uh-huh. So I would be hesitant to make the claim that people then were better informed than people now. I'm kind of skeptical of that. But
isn't it interesting though? It's kind of like the TVs get. This is my analogy. The TVs get better. You know, they're flat screen, they're fancy, they got HDD, whatever, and yet the programming gets worse. So we have access to all this information, and yet the ability to think and discern information gets worse. So you got to know somewhat of what you stand for before you can filter through the lies.
So I think some of the programming's worse, some of the programming's better, right? I mean, do you prefer the world in which Dan Rather told you what the news was every day?
No.
Right. And today you have options.
No.
Today you do not need to, you do not need to listen to him. Mm-hmm. If you do listen to him, you don't need to accept him.
Right.
And you can challenge him. And there are people doing that on the internet and on blogs and on social media every single day.
Right.
I think I prefer this world
to
that one. This world with all the flaws, with all the lies, with all the fake news. Mm-hmm. I prefer this one to that one.
Yeah, remember that it was the left who came up with that term, the fake news first, Trump co-opted the term.
Right. So
people forget.
Well, so what is fake news? Well, first of all, we've always had fake news.
Right.
Right.
You said that yesterday.
Fake news has as long as people have lied, there has been fake news, and so fake news has a long history in American journalism. Fake news is, at one point it's called yellow journalism, a century ago. Mm-hmm. Today we call it fake news. And that's a catchy little phrase.
Which the left came up with.
Well, the left. So
in
the
order
left,
to distrust the stuff coming out about Hillary Clinton.
What's new about it now is that the left advances a claim that this is a new thing, that this is a new thing and that's right. It's caused by like Russian Twitter.
Right. And it was all factual before that.
Yeah, it's all fact. Right. And that's just not true. And it's the result of liberals losing control of the mainstream media.
Yeah. Yeah. I only have a couple more minutes with you. Thank you so much for coming in person and allowing this beautiful studio. I want people to know just what a distinguished professor we have here, and you can learn something more about him and read his stuff. He is the author of 5 books, including one called The First Assassin. And what? Who's that?
Well, that's a novel.
A novel.
That's the funnest book I've written.
The funnest.
The funnest.
Do people use that word at Hillsdale College?
You know, I use it.
Funnest.
I use it.
But you say it on purpose.
I do it ironically. But it's the funnest book. It's called The First Assassin, and it's basically this. It's Day of the Jackal, set in 1861 Washington. There's a hitman on the loose trying to assassinate President Lincoln at the start of his presidency, as the guns are booming at Fort Sumter, not at the end, which is you know when it happened. And the book is a thriller. It's meant to entertain, but it's partly based on some reality.
Well, and you know, if you are so inclined, and I'll bet you are after hearing Professor Miller speak, you can read his stuff at National Review. He's got a huge byline there and lots of stuff that he's written. You write a column every week, don't you?
No, I contribute to the magazine.
The magazine
with features, right. And I post on the website,
write for Wall Street Journal.
I contribute to that.
And
paper.
So he has a website, Professor John J. Miller, called www.heymiller.com. So you can go to www.heymiller.com, and believe it or not, at our commercial break, which is like 2 minutes, people are going to hear a Hillsdale Constitutional Minute.
So we're always educating.
You are always educating, and we're always soaking it up. Thank you so much, Professor John J. Miller, for being with us here on Spouting Off. Pleasure to meet you.
Karen, I've enjoyed Spouting Off with you.
Great. Thank you very much. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back with one more professor. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sarah, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arn, on the 3 branches of government.
There's a lot of confusion these days about the relationship of the 3 branches of government, especially among many who are in government. Some think the judiciary sits atop the other 2 branches, the legislative and the executive. Others think the president sits above Congress and the courts. In fact, all 3 branches are equally accountable to the Constitution and therefore to the people who made the Constitution. The President, members of Congress, and federal judges all take an oath to the Constitution. In making the laws, Congress must adhere to the Constitution. In executing the laws, the President must abide by the Constitution. In interpreting the laws, judges are bound by the Constitution. All the people's representatives are accountable to the Constitution, and therein lies our liberty.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket Constitution and Declaration, go to constitutionminute.com.
Do you have a secret that's been bothering you? Have you been wondering if what you're thinking or feeling is normal? Is there someone with whom you've needed to clear the air, but you haven't been able to find the right words? Sometimes you need an objective, second opinion to help you see your problem more clearly. Ask Aunt Emma, and she'll help you move past what's getting in your way. She's a former therapist who is wise and caring, but instead of therapy, she'll give you terrific advice. It's free to ask Aunt Emma and explain your need, problem, or question. If you both agree, you pay only $1.39 a minute. It's anonymous, it's confidential, and you'll be surprised at how effective it is. You can ask Aunt Emma by going to facebook.com/askAuntEmma. There, you'll find her phone number and extension number. That's facebook.com/askAuntEmma. Ask Aunt Emma today.
Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. It's a community of like-minded people who work together to pay for their medical costs. You choose your doctor and hospital, starting at $107 a month for a single, up to $449 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all kids. For more info, visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org.
Okay, and so we're back live, Hillsdale College. This is a special edition. We're here, I'm here on campus participating in a CCA, and people always ask me, what's a CCA? And I have to remember, it's called the Center for Constructive Alternatives. Now, that doesn't really say much. I've asked them, they need to change that name, but I think they're going to do a dedication to somebody who gives lots of money, probably. But nonetheless, it is a wonderful opportunity 3-4 times a year to come and pretty much be a student at Hillsdale College. It's the best deal going. They probably don't want me to tell you this, but if you can get here, if you can fly here and then find a place to stay, and they do have places on campus, but they go quickly, they'll feed you, they'll take care of you and everything else, and your brain will get a workout. So the CCA that I'm participating in that will be done on Wednesday afternoon is about the 60s. And seeing as how I was growing up and in grade school in the 60s, I thought it'd be really, really neat to see that, and I'm having just a great, great time. So let me give the numbers, because if you'd like to call in and ask a question to our second guest here, we'll be able to do that and accommodate you. We're doing this live on January 30th, and as you know, our programs live forever on iTunes and lots of other places. So if you'd like to participate, you can call 888-627-6008, or you can call direct 323-744-4831. Now, we were happy enough, pleasure enough to have with us the head of the journalism department, and now we have the head of, I guess you would call, the radio department, right? We have Scott Bertram, who's a professor here at Hillsdale College, and did I get that right or am I wrong? Is you teach radio and, yes, and talk radio, right?
Yes, correct. But technically, Mr. Miller, John Miller, who was on previously, yes, is my boss.
Right,
so
I got that.
I have to be nice to him and say nice things about him.
I don't think that would be difficult. But you've had quite the career yourself. And it started in a music-based kind of college station, and then you became a sports radio reporter for Chicago, in Chicago. And then, so you are a sports guy, right? You like sports.
Yes. I always thought I'd end up in sports radio. And I did for, I guess, 5-6 years in total before heading off to News Talk. And I still watch and love, and it's almost better having a little distance from working in the industry, I think.
Yeah. So what was it that decided that was the deciding factor for you to come to a place like Hillsdale, which is such rarefied air, I think?
Yeah, right? I wasn't even looking for a job. The story is true. I bet I tell people I wasn't looking for a change in jobs, but I was reading National Reviews, The Corner.
That's
National
the
Review,
kicker.
Where John writes, and he posted about a job opening here at Hillsdale, the chance to come in and build and mold this new radio station and teach radio to these young students. And I thought if there were going to be a job that would open up and I'd leave for, that would be one of them. The opportunity to continue to work in radio, the opportunity to work with students and young people interested in broadcasting, and the opportunity to come to a place like Hillsdale. So, I would never have found it, you know, on job boards. I would never have found it anywhere else because I wasn't searching in those places. But the fact that I was reading National Review and I saw John's post, everything, and there are so many little things that come together, right? So I had to go tell my wife, and I had to tell her that you just know things. I knew if I applied for this job that I'd get it. I knew it. Mm-hmm. I knew it. And so I had to tell my wife, you know, this is serious. Now, it's not like hypothetical. would you move to Michigan in the middle of nowhere if I get this job? Think about it very seriously. And then I submitted my resume to Hillsdale, and this is absolutely true. Pressed send, walked up to the front desk of the radio station where I was working at, and checked my mailbox. And in the mailbox, I got a package, bring the package back to my desk, open it up, and it is that book that is sitting right there. Not that specific book, but Churchill's Trial by Dr. Larry Arn. So seconds after I send my resume to Hillsdale, I get a package, unsolicited package in the mail that contained Dr. Arn, the president of Hillsdale Challenge. President of college, his book. So everything was.
Well, how many sports reporters, I don't know, this is probably an unfair stereotype, how many sports reporters read National Review? I guess there are a few.
I'm sure there's a
few. Maybe there are a few.
Yeah.
Kind of like, you know, putting the Judeo in Judeo-Christian. Mm-hmm. There are a few.
There are a few.
But not too many. So, yeah, I mean, that was a self-selected group.
Yes.
Looking for someone who reads National Review. Yeah.
By that point, I was doing News Talk. So I was sports talk right after college, and then I moved on to doing News Talk. So I was working in the News Talk
News
station
talk.
When the opportunity came along.
Yeah, and it has to be said that I'm sure Hillsdale College does not self-select and ask you, are you a conservative? Do you read National Review?
No.
But you got to figure that for a broadcaster with your experience to come to a place like Hillsdale College, you have to love what they teach here.
It's self-selection the other way, right? I mean, it's people who apply.
I don't think a social justice warrior would be really happy here, would they?
I will say this. Know. We have actually, there was a story on this in the Collegian last year at some point,
really?
Talking about, you know, Democrats or liberals who were teaching, and there are a few, and there's a Hillsdale College Democrats Club or whatever, you know, the student Democrats, whatever they call themselves, and everybody gets along. I mean, people ask me what Hillsdale is like. That's the question I get, because people know about Hillsdale from seeing the commercials or hearing the commercials or listening to Dr. Arn. You know, what's it like? And I tell them, it's exactly what you think it is. That's what I found. The picture you have in your mind when you hear the commercials and you listen to Dr. Arn, you think about what it's like to have these really amazing people coming. You know, Larry Elder was here yesterday, and Jody Bottoms here today.
My aphrodisiac.
But everyone is wonderful. The students are of a different class, cut from a different cloth. It's just a fantastic place.
Yeah. This is my second CCA, and the first one was like 9 years ago.
Mm.
And I had the pleasure of sitting with Dr. Arn in his office. I don't know what made me such a, you know, privileged character. But he said his favorite thing to do, and I ended up, I've been spending time doing exactly what his favorite thing is to do, which is to go into the student dining room and sit down with the students and just talk to them.
He'll do
and
that.
It is extraordinary. Not only their poise, but their intelligence and their ability to listen and their enthusiasm. It's kind of scary because it is rarefied air. I was talking to John Miller about that. It's kind of rarefied air. And you go back into the real world and you say, oh, my God. And it's like, where? So and there is a lot to be said for kind of sitting on a mountaintop and, you know, pondering the world before you go out into it. So I guess I've softened about that. I kept wanting people at the panel to say, it's insane. It's worse than it's ever been. And they didn't say that. They said, no, in 1847, there was this. And in 1921, there was that. So what is learned in broadcasting and what is talent in broadcasting? It's a nice general question for you.
Yeah. So that I usually get a different side of that question, which is, can someone with a bad voice still be in broadcasting? And that answered now more than ever is yes.
Yes.
It just, absolutely.
And yours doesn't qualify as a bad voice.
Thank
you have
you
a
very
terrific
much.
Voice.
But I think, look, we have, I'm thinking of the students we have involved now. We have 40 plus students involved, and we have the most outgoing, gregarious, talkative people on one end. And I have people in mind who you would say are quite introverted and perhaps aren't the most loquacious. Then actually the number of people who are introverts who are in broadcasting is high. They do it I do it. I was, am an introvert. It forces you to do these things, to talk to people, to, you know, you go to a press conference, you're expected to ask questions. It's okay for, you know, people expect you to talk and speak up. So I think that brings that personality aspect out of those people who perhaps might not use it as much as others. And then from there, you know, I have kind of this playbook. You know, we go through this checklist before anyone gets on the air if they want to do a show or a feature. And then we kind of turn them loose, and I don't say anything to them for the first three shows. I just let them, you know, three shows. We already have the rundown. We know what they're going to talk about. I have confidence they're not going to do bad things. And I let them go for three shows and just let them explore what the show is and what they want their voice to be. And after three, then we sit down and I say, well, you know, we could do this a little better. Or why don't we do that? So I think, you know, talk about talent is just as much as I can allowing them to be themselves, the genuineness that I think comes across the microphone. And from there trying to make that into the best show or the best broadcast possible.
Wonderful. So let's get back to the opinion stuff, because you said you were doing news radio and that sort of thing. So here's a pretty general question. So what do you think about the general state of journalism today?
Well, I think that on the whole, and I think John echoed this yesterday at the panel, in a very strong way, it's never been better, meaning there are so many avenues and there are so many publications, there are so many authors, and it is so easy to find them. The amount of information that's available to us in seconds. You know, I just think back to people doing show prep for news talk shows, just in the 1990s, not that long ago, where you'd be limited to the USA Today and perhaps your local paper, and maybe the New York Times or the Post comes from out of town, and that's what you have to go on. You know, that's the extent of the prep that you have, what's happening in those outlets, and maybe you caught the news, the TV news the night before, right? And these days you can go anywhere and everywhere to find the news. Now, that puts a burden on the reader or the listener to be a little discerning about what is trustworthy, who is accurate, who do you go back to over and over again, who's going to give you the whole story and not part of the story, which outlets have a liberal slant, which outlets have a conservative slant to them. The great part is that it's out there and you can find it. And the challenging part is that I think media consumers, to be good media consumers, have to be knowledgeable and and well-read consumers.
And they're not.
And that could be a challenge.
Well, and I shouldn't say that in such a broad generalization, but there really are a lot of people. What I keep coming up with, and of course it comes from my personal opinion and worldview, is that the level of gullibility comes into play. You get to decide. Let me just back up a second, because this gets right into something that is one of kind of like a study that I've been making for a while. I'm a social worker, among other things, and I've been fascinated by things like Scientology. Scientology fascinates me, and cults in general fascinate me. I wrote a big, long piece about at least, I don't know, 15 or 20 ways in which Scientology tactics are similar to the cult of liberalism, and how, you know, so what is it that helps a person break out of a cult? And what is it that's going to enlighten them as to the fact that it's possible they're being lied to? I wish that there were classes about that sort of thing, you know, because Hillsdale does not tell you what to think, unlike what people think. I'm not sure where I'm going with this, but Hillsdale doesn't tell people what to think. They teach them how to think. So the question is, do you have to have a class in gullibility today in order to wade your way through the news? What do you think? I mean, I think you kind of do, especially since the great majority of people haven't had a Hillsdale education. And they don't know anything about the Constitution, or at least what the principles of this country was founded upon.
Let me take that this way. I am... there's another debate happening now, or at least discussion, right, about the overall distrust in media, which I don't think is unfounded. But the fact that 30 years ago, a large percentage of the population had these universal truths or trusted sources, you know, CBS, NBC, ABC, your Peter Jennings and your Tom Brokaw and your
Dan
Rathers, right?
But about truth.
But people watched and generally thought that that was what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have that these days. People are getting their information from all over the place. And perhaps you are getting information from sources that only align with your views. And look, I don't know what to do about that.
It's a balkanization, though, because most people read the stuff that agrees with what they already think.
Correct.
So you've got balkanization all over the country now that thinks they're living in a totally different world than somebody else.
But I would still say I would much rather that we have the flow of information, the number of sources available.
Absolutely.
And the overwhelming amount of writing and reporting we have these days from all corners, than to go back and say, you know, again, 30 years ago, at least everyone sort of believed the same news was accurate. And so the problem with people only reading things that that they agree with, I mean, I don't know how you change that. That's human nature in some ways. Mm-hmm. And it is a problem on the left. But I think it's also a problem on the right in some ways. I'm a big Twitter guy, and I try to have.
And you're admitting that?
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding. I am too.
I try to have at least a handful
of
left liberal thinkers, writers, who at least I consider to be on the up and up, thinking. Not to impugn the rest of them, but thinking liberals, people who might have their minds changed on certain issues. And there's, you know, 5 to 10 in my feed at any point in time. And I can at least look and say, well, that's what the thing. You know, that goes to something, if I can move a little bit towards what I tell our journalism students. And that is, you know, when you're doing a broadcast and, you know, we have 20 plus shows on the station. And one of the questions I get most often, too, is how many of those are political? Because Hillsdale is thought of as a very political place. But to be honest, I did the math at some point. It's probably like 30%-ish that are pure, you know, political type shows. And the other 70% are sports or personal passions or science. But, you know, those people who are doing the political shows always tell them, you know, if you're gonna craft an argument, if you're gonna make an argument, if you want to convince your listeners that you're right, more than anything else, you have to understand the opposing argument. Mm-hmm. You have to understand the opposition's best argument against them, against you, and how do you defuse that? How do you argue against it? You know, when I was hosting, you know, if I was doing a monologue type piece, trying to make a point, trying to make an argument, I always would seek out and try to find those arguments against my point of view, and though I thought they were ridiculous or wrong, to attack them in the course of making my argument. I think it makes your argument stronger, and it also sort of foresees an argument that's coming against you. So in that way, I think it's, you know, I of course encourage people to do that, but in terms of, you know, forcing people or telling them stop being so gullible, or those sorts of things, I don't have a perfect answer for that.
No, and there isn't a perfect answer. We had Peter Collier, who, excuse me, I would love to interview at some time, because he, excuse me, was with, I don't have a cough button here, so I'm he was with David Horowitz and Ramparts, and they do a thing at Restoration Weekend called Second Thoughts. And I happened to catch it. So it's really interesting. And that's what I'm talking about, is what was that moment that gave you the second thought? In their case, it was pretty dramatic. The Black Panthers killed their bookkeeper, yeah. You know, but it was this, you know, it took them 7 years to get out of liberalism and to start questioning it. So I think that's really important. And it's important to have that questioning mind, yeah. No matter what.
And I think, again,
no matter what,
again, the flow of information or the arguments that are out there, it's on us. It's on conservatives to continue to make the case as loudly and as vociferously as possible, so that information's out there and available to
right.
people if they want to find it, if they want to seek it out. And, you know, I think I just think of, you know, some issues that perhaps we should be talking more about. And I don't know if Larry Elder mentioned this yesterday. I think someone did during the CCA. You know, the topic of school choice. I moved from Illinois, mm-hmm. which is a deep blue state, and we don't have school choice. And mm-hmm. where you live is where you're going to school, and unless you're going to send your kid to a private school. Mm-hmm. And we come to Michigan 2 years ago, and one of the big differences I tell people is that Michigan is a school choice state. Mm-hmm. You know, here in Hillsdale, I can send my son to the public school. I can send my son to the charter school in town. I can send my son to the other charter school in town. Mm-hmm. I can send my son to Jonesville, which is a bit north of here. I can send my son 15 miles away if I want.
To the Hillsdale K-12, if you can get in.
Right, or Hillsdale Academy.
Hillsdale Academy.
The academy is not right. part of the choice system, so that's private.
Oh, okay, it's not
The charters is just like going, you know, right. I want to go here or here, and it uh-huh. doesn't cost the parent either way.
Right.
The academy, though, is a private tuition.
Uh-huh.
And that's not the case in Illinois. And it makes everything better. The mm-hmm. public schools in Hillsdale, and just doing some research as my kids get to that age, are pretty darn good. And mm-hmm. part of that is because they're challenged by schools nearby.
Competition.
Yes.
And sounds like a free
choice.
Market philosophy to me. I don't know.
And generally, you know, it polls very well. Yeah. School choice polls very well. And the opposition is the teachers' unions, which by and large support Democrats.
Right.
But that seems like a fight worth having. That seems like a fight
sure.
where you're able to make a point on school choice that then educates the public and voters about what the free market and competition can do in other sectors of society. Right.
Yeah, but there's so much. I mean, I agree with you. There's just we have to be able to fight the demagoguery. Because for every rational, logical argument that a conservative makes, a liberal calls you a racist, a bigot, a homophobe, a xenophobe. You're against public education. You don't like minorities.
Hate teachers.
Hate teachers. Hate the government. Everything is twisted to a ridiculous degree. The good news is, and we're coming almost to the end, we have about a few minutes left to talk about what you want to talk about. Right? See, he changed the conversation to school choice, which was a very, very good shift. and what was I going to say? I don't know. The good news is that liberals are very bad at talk radio. You know that? They cannot do it, so at least so far. Because in talk radio, you do have to put forth a logical argument and be willing to challenge, mm-hmm. to be challenged. And everybody's always going to challenge you. See, it's in my DNA because I'm Jewish and I love to argue. And I never agree with everybody all the time. So it's just part of the culture, right? But liberals, you can only call people racist for so long without an argument before people turn you off. They'll still feel bad, but you won't be able to persuade them of anything.
Mm-hmm.
So the history of liberals in talk radio is extremely bad. And so that's kind of a good thing, but that's neither here nor there. Now, do you write and do you like?
Yeah, so you know,
have
one of
a
the,
book out.
One of,
that
great,
I can
one of the very great things about Hillsdale, one of the
yes.
reasons I'm here, is they encourage all of us in the journalism department to remain professionally active. So
yeah.
we keep our contacts up, we keep our skills sharp, we have contacts for internships and jobs.
Good.
And it's fabulous. So I fill in on talk shows in Michigan, I fill in on talk shows in Illinois.
Excellent.
I do some reporting for Illinois News Network. But the big one, I guess, that people might most be interested in is I host a podcast for National Review.
Oh, you do?
And it's called Political Beats. So my co-host and I.
The red beats or the, like, on the beat beat?
On the beat beat.
Okay. We're not talking the beets you eat.
No.
Okay.
So we have guests from around the world of politics, so writers and analysts, talking heads, staffers, whomever it is. And we don't spend a single second talking about politics. We are talking about our guests, either favorite artist or favorite band. We talk music on the show. So, for example, with the 60s theme this week, we didn't plan it this way.
Right.
But we talked with Bruce Edward Walker with the Acton Institute here in Michigan and does some freelance with the Federalist and elsewhere. And we spent almost 2 hours with him talking about the Monkees and their career and their music and their albums. We're talking this week with Eli Lake from Bloomberg about Steely Dan, the band. Next week, actually, John Miller is going to be the guest, and we'll talk about the Police with him. So it's political people. It's names you know and voices you know, and you know their work. But we're talking about a little more of the personal side.
Kind of like Charles Krauthammer's love for baseball.
Yeah, and George Will as well. George Will loves baseball. But so it allows a little
Some of
departure.
Us don't love George Will, but that's right. Beside the point. How many people bring up classical music, or is it just gauche?
We've done, well, the answer is zero.
Well, you should have me on, because I'll talk about – I used to be a classical radio announcer, but that doesn't mean that I'm a walking encyclopedia about it. But I do love it, and a lot of people are afraid to actually admit that they love – I grew up on it. That's what I grew up on.
Yeah.
So I didn't get into Joni Mitchell until, like, 1982. So and all of a sudden, it was like a whole new world for me.
Yeah.
Scott Bertram, you're a joy to have on. I've got 1 minute left, and I got to tell people that they can contact me at www.karencataline.com, Facebook, Karen Cataline, Twitter, same thing. And that's as many social medias as I plan to have. So please go to hillsdale.edu if you want to learn more about Hillsdale College. It is an extraordinary place. And we'll be back next week live. I don't know what we'll be talking about, but you just never know. Thanks again to Scott Bertram and to all the people at Hillsdale College for hosting us here on Spouting Off. This is Karen Cataline, and stay tuned next week when we'll have more Spouting Off.